There we go. All right. Welcome to the last tutorial that we're having here for the Data Science for Security and Forensics course. And I think before I get into the details regarding the tutorial today, has anybody taken a look at the tutorial problems? If not, that's okay. We'll just go over them. So I wanted to bring up some topics that some students were discussing about. So for instance, there were some discussions or concerns about what the format of the homework should look like. And basically, the emphasis here is that you can write your answers to the questions as they are presented in the homework. You can write it in an academic format if you wish to. The main point is it has to be your own work. And so, for instance, if you were taking code from online, your code should be, A, you should reference that you're doing that, but B, your code should be sufficiently different that I can tell, like, you're using your own brain to modify it and adjust it to fit the particular problem. So if you copy and paste the code in your homework, and sometimes I can see that, yes?
By homework, do you mean assignment?
I do mean assignments. So assignments 1, 2, 3, and 4. If I can copy and paste your solution into Google and the source comes up extremely easily, and especially, you know, if you just changed the variable names, I mean, that's like, unfortunately, that's plagiarism. And actually, we don't like dealing with plagiarism, but then we tell the people, like, oh, maybe this is plagiarism, and then people in the administration have to deal with it, and it wastes my time, it wastes your time. So as long as you produce homework that's your own, then we're all happy. You can submit your homework as PDFs with code files on the side. You can submit them as Jupyter Notebooks. I accept these. Okay, so let's just get into the actual subject. Clustering. Okay, well, I've spoiled a bit there, but can anybody tell me more or less what clustering is? He says, cluster data. How so? In which ways?
Just grouping of data.
Grouping of data. Yeah, that is more or less what it is. Anybody else have any opinions on the subject? No. He's not wrong. Main point is that you're using these algorithms to identify groups in unlabeled data. So, for instance, you have this data here and just, say, these two features. And you apply clustering on this data, choosing three clusters. Your algorithm might settle upon, okay, according to this data and the number of clusters that I was given, these look like to be, say, the three most prominent groups in this data. So that is the main gist of what clustering is. This is unsupervised learning. Data is not labeled, right? Are any of you familiar with the different kinds of clustering methods that exist? We ask here for a taxonomy. It doesn't necessarily need to be like an actual tree of a taxonomy, but are you familiar with any of the different methods at least? Yeah, he's asking, what is the difference between classifying and clustering the groups? And say, if you are lucky, there would not be much of a difference. However, in classification, you're working with supervised data. You're working with data which actually has labels. In clustering, the whole point is just to guess whether or not you actually have labels, what group they belong to. So it's saying, based on their features, in this case, this in two dimensions, it looks like these items are closely related together, therefore they belong to a particular group. So in a more technical level, clustering and classification differ really greatly when it comes to the models that you're training. So with classification, you may end up with something with, okay, based on the input, and these parameters that we've tuned, If the input to this model with this particular sample falls above this particular threshold, it belongs to class 0 or class 1. For instance, too, with clustering, there's not only this hard clustering that we're showing here. It's possible that you can have clusterings where you say, okay, this point here, if you can see my mouse, maybe belongs 33% to the green group, 33% to the blue group, 33% to the red group. The thing, too, is that the certainty you have kind of with respect to evaluating your clusters is much, much less than it is for classification. Because for classification, you have these labels, you have these metrics like accuracy, et cetera, et cetera. With clustering, usually we don't have these things. And it's nice sometimes because then you can take data which has no labels, which means you do not have to annotate the data and see the groupings of data together. Otherwise, you got to go and put annotations on all that data and label everything. So jumping back to this, have you heard of any particular methods with regards to clustering? There is canopy clustering, and if I'm not mistaken, it's one of these hierarchical methods. I'll be honest, I'm not super familiar with canopy clustering, but it is a method. What about k-means? Have you heard of k-means? Which is different from k-nearest neighbors. This is another one. But kind of going generally over what clustering is, like I was saying, it's unsupervised learning. We don't know the sample labels or classes. It reveals the structures in unlabeled or unclassified data sets. Like we're saying, it pushes or tries to identify the groups that exist in a data set. And these groups or structures, kind of at the technical level, are based on a dissimilarity or similarity measure, such as the distance. So how do you say this group is different from that group? Well, there, quite often we use the Euclidean distance thing. There's quite a spread between the two, for instance. Or even within a particular cluster, you want to measure how much spread exists in a cluster. So the clusters have these two important qualities. There's the inter-cluster distance, that is the distance between actual clusters, how isolated they are. So my hands are the clusters, right? Two different ones. Then there's intercluster distance. If it is open, it's very spread. If it's closed, it's very compact. Density of the cluster. And you can be more assured, say, at a realistic level, that the identifications of your clusters that have been made are more likely to be true if the clusters are like this, as opposed to like this. See what I mean? So this is the point I was trying to demonstrate. We have more confidence in clusters with high intercluster distance and low intracluster distance, right? So here we can say, okay, yeah, that looks right. Whereas opposed to here, given that we're saying that there are three clusters in this data, this is a hyperparameter. Quite often with these clustering algorithms, you have to choose it before. It cannot be trained for. Here you can see that there's a difference between this kind of light blue class and this brown class. There's a pretty solid line between the two of them, which makes you think, okay, maybe this isn't the best set of clusters we could have generated. Yeah? This is just a taxonomy from the Kononenko book that we're using for class. And the points I really want to highlight is that there are more or less two major kinds of clustering methods, that being hierarchical, which is all about either splitting the data into smaller and smaller subgroups or agglomerating data from smaller subgroups and merging them, versus partitional, which is probably best explained discussing the k-means method of clustering. But then there's also a very popular method. There's other methods too, like I think it's called c-means, which is a kind of soft clustering where it gives certain probabilities that data points belong to different clusters. And then a very good method called Gaussian mixture models that uses the method of optimization called expectation maximization, which we're going to talk about a little bit today. But right, and for instance, these methods usually have some sort of objective function or error function that you're trying to optimize, or at least you can explain it that way. So k-means uses the square error, and then expectation maximization is trying to maximize the likelihood that some particular Gaussian distributions created the underlying data. We'll talk about this later. And here we have the different methods regarding hierarchical clustering, which we're also going to talk about. Okay, so now on to kind of the details of hierarchical and partitional methods. First, hierarchical. So this is the basic idea. Say you have these data points, P, Q, R, S, and T. There's two main methods in which this data can be clustered using hierarchical methods. Either you let all the data points start up as their own individual clusters in the beginning, and you merge the closest data points into a cluster, and then you kind of increase the, say, threshold or distance between the clusters, and you say you merge the next most close items. Then, for instance, here you see S and T is then merging with RST, and then likewise, at the end, you have PQ and RST, these two different clusters merging together. This is the agglomerative approach, going upwards. And this is just a representation of the merging of the data points as a tree. Alternatively, you can go the other direction. So you start at the very top, where you have everything as a single cluster, and then using some sort of metric or, some sort of heuristic or rule of thumb, you start splitting the clusters. Say, into the clusters which have good, say, compactness and good spread between them, for instance. So it's the reverse of the agglomerative approach. Here we're splitting this into RST and PQ, so on and so forth. Okay, so that was kind of at the abstract level, but now we can look at hierarchical clustering, the agglomerative approach, kind of more at a practical level. All right. So here we have some data set in two dimensions. And at the lowest level, we're saying, okay, let's at first merge together the data points that are closest together to create some larger clusters. So here we can see the Euclidean distance between A and B and D and E, in this case, maybe is equivalent. We merge them, right? The next step, the next closest clusters, and the distance between clusters is based upon these link types, which we're going to talk about in a second. So the cluster of A, B, and C is the next closest together, so we merge them. Yeah? And you can see how this is represented in the tree. The next closest clusters is D and E and F, so we merge them. And then finally, if we wanted to merge everything together, we would merge these two different clusters. You see how that works, this agglomerative approach to clustering? And for instance, once you have tree made, this dendrogram, you can kind of draw a line on it where you want to say, okay, we're going to limit the, say, amount of agglomerative clustering up to this point. So if you draw a line here, then you would say you would have the clusters of ABC as a cluster, you have the data points as ABC as a cluster, and the points DE as a cluster, and F as a cluster, right? Okay, so then there's the question, okay, all right, well, how do you calculate the distances between the different clusters that you're looking at? Well, we have a couple of very popular methods. There's single linkage, which is the distance between clusters is the minimum distance between the elements of each cluster. And this is shown in this drawing here. So you have this cluster here and this cluster here. The distance between the two of these via the single linkage is this, right? The two nearest points of each cluster. Then you have complete linkage. This is the distance between clusters. It's the maximum distance between elements in each cluster. So it's like the opposite of single linkage. So in this case, you have the furthest point in each cluster from each other to measure the distances. Yeah. Then we have two more, the average linkage, which is a bit more complex to calculate. So I believe, I'm just quoting these folks from Princeton, saying rather than the worst or best distances, when using the average linkage criterion, we average over all possible pairs between the groups. So that means you're going to have to calculate the distance between this point, this point, this point, this point, this point, et cetera, et cetera. Take the average. It's a lot of work to do. And then there is centroid linkage, the distance between the actual centers of the clusters. So for instance, you can calculate the center, the centroid of the cluster, more or less taking the averages of the features of each cluster to calculate the centroid. And then you just measure the Euclidean distance, or whichever distance metric you're using, between the two different clusters, right? So the link types make sense? Okay, then there is the other method of hierarchical clustering, the divisive approach, the top-down one, where you start with one large cluster and then you divide it into smaller clusters. So like a true implementation of this method would have to perform all possible divisions of the clusters in order to optimize the distances between the new clusters and their compactness. However, generally these algorithms use some kind of more or less greedy heuristic approach. So imagine you have some gigantic data set. And realistically, you'd have to make every single partition possible between the two different clusters, or within the cluster, to make two new clusters, to find the optimal clusters that are being made. But generally speaking, that's not effective. We take the greedy approach. Okay. Now, partitional clustering. This is kind of the more, I'd say, popular version of clustering. Kononenko defines this as algorithms that produce a partition, just a split, of examples into a specified number of clusters by either minimizing or maximizing some numerical criterion. So some limitations to this method as opposed to hierarchical or agglomerative clustering, In hierarchical clustering, because of the way it works, you technically don't need to specify beforehand, say, I want this many clusters. Of course, you'll have to end up drawing this line and saying, okay, we don't want all these clusters to merge together. But a much stronger kind of hyperparameter for partitional clustering is that partitional clustering, you always have to have the hyperparameter of the number of clusters. You, the person, have to say, okay, I'm going to guess that when we do k-means or this other method that there should be three clusters or four clusters or five clusters, right? The model itself does not tune the number of clusters to be chosen. So partitional clustering, it's probably best illustrated by k-means, which we're going to talk about in a second. Shortly after dissimilarity measure, which is kind of the more technical word for distance, more or less. So in order to cluster items in a data set together, there's some degree of association. Quite often we just refer to this as, say, the Euclidean distance. This is the most popular dissimilarity or similarity metric. Yeah, but there's other measures of similarity or dissimilarity. And then it also depends on the particular problem you're working with. Most cases, you're using the Euclidean distance. So in the past, we've seen things like the Manhattan distance. There is something called the Mahalanobis distance. I'm always terrible at saying that word. These are also possible different metrics or measures you can use. Okay, so I want to talk about k-means. And we're not familiar with it, so I'm going to jump right into it. Here's how it works. In this algorithm, you choose some k number of clusters. You initialize, maybe I can draw, well, I'll draw it. Do we have any pens here? No. I'll draw it after I explain. You initialize some random k number of centroids. These are the centers of your clusters. And the best practice is to place them as far away as possible from each other. Then what you do is you, so let's actually look at this example while we're talking about the explanation. So here, the centroids are the triangles. We initialize them in this location, in this location. Yeah? We then partition data points to its closest centroid. So here, we then measure the distance between the centroid, this yellow centroid here, to all the other, to the, all the data points in your data set. And you do the same for the red one. And basically, you say, okay, all the data points that are closer to red are now in the red cluster. All the data points that are closer to yellow are now in the yellow cluster, right? Okay, so that is kind of one iteration. We then do more iterations, where what you first do is we recalculate the centroids of our clusters based on the data point assignments. So, okay, we were here, but now given this cluster here of our, of all the yellow points, we can say, okay, this is clearly not the center of this cluster. It's here, right? So you're taking the average of these points to find the center. You do the same with the red data point, right? You recalculate the centroid position. And basically, you just repeat this process until convergence. That is, the clusters do no longer switch members. It's no longer possible, essentially. So looking here, recall this was our new centroid that we calculated, and new centroid that we calculated. And then again, we're taking the distances from the centroids to all the data points for both clusters. And the points which are closer to the red centroid are assigned as the red cluster. Likewise, the points that are closest to the yellow data point are assigned to the yellow cluster. And again, we recalculate the position of the centroid. We calculate the new center of the cluster. And we do this repeat, repeat, until you can't repeat anymore. Right? So does this make sense, this algorithm? You have your centroids. You calculate which data points are closest to that centroid. That creates the cluster. You recalculate the center of the cluster, the centroid of the cluster, based on these new data points. And then you essentially repeat this process of distance between the centroids and recalculating the centroid. Yeah? All right, so important things is that the initial positions of the centroids and the choice of k are hyperparameters. It's not something that your model learns. There's methods that you can try to do to optimize it, like just doing cross-validation, for instance. But more or less, yes, it's up to you. So that's k-means. So this is a interactive example. I'm going to let it run a few times. The screen is not the greatest here, but you can see here, for instance, we're having centroids start approximately here, here, and roughly here. And over about 11 iterations, they move from their initial points, and based on reassigning the different data points to the different centroids or the different clusters, you can see the centroids move, and then finally converge until no more, say, swaps between clusters and their data points can occur. Yeah? I've been emphasizing this point, but for the best results, the number of clusters k is ideally none before. Sometimes you don't know what the number of clusters are in a data set. You don't know how many groupings of different data belong there. And sometimes you just have to do trial and error. Then also, initial centroids have to be placed appropriately in order to get a proper division. So sometimes if you have a poorly placed centroid, you may end up with a cluster with nothing inside of it. It's entirely possible. And you can get different results for clustering on the same data set, but say with different starting points for your initial centroids. So here we have the same data set, but given that these centroids started in different locations, you can see here there's a difference in how the clustering ended up. Yeah? Some possible failures with k-means. You can have a poorly chosen k. In particular, if you choose too few clusters, so realistically you're merging groups of data that should not be merged together, or you have too many clusters where, say, your clusters are too small, they're overly specific. And like I said before, you can have unlucky starting positions of the centroids, which makes it worthwhile to maybe run clustering analysis with multiple times with different starting points for the centroids, or a different number of chosen K clusters. Okay, so we described k-means before without the use of this objective function or this error function, but it does indeed have it. And more or less, it's the sum of squared errors. In particular, what we're looking at is called the within cluster sum of squared errors. And this is the function that is being optimized during this k-means clustering. So all this is first, pretend like this first summation does not exist. What we're looking right now is this here. This is saying for all the points in this particular cluster, I want you to calculate the distance between the centroid and that point squared. So that's, say, a measure of variance or compactness of a particular cluster. Now you add up all of the different, say, measures of compactness for the clusters you calculate, and this is more or less a representation of your error, or your objective function that you're trying to minimize in this case. Right. So minimization of this measure will correspond to cluster convergence. And of course, it's very possible that this your clustering falls into a local minimum. You have no guarantee to reach some global minimum with respect to this objective function, at least with k-means. Okay, so you're like, all right, well, how do we use this? How do we use this function? Why is it important? Well, one useful item regarding this objective function is that we can, if we don't know what the appropriate number of k clusters is before we do the clustering, we can use a particular method called the elbow method. And this is the most popular method for choosing the k number of clusters. It's also extremely informal, but funnily enough, it's maybe the most accepted method. And essentially what we're doing here is you run k-means on your data with an increasing value of k and record this within cluster sum of squared errors for each result. So for example, here on the vertical axis, we have this error value. And on the horizontal axis, we have the number of k clusters. And as you can see, as k increases, technically speaking, this error will decrease. But we don't want to choose the cluster with the lowest error. What we actually want to do here is the best k is at the elbow of the results. That is this particular bend, maybe roughly around here or here, where you can see that by increasing the amount of clusters k, we're starting to get diminishing returns on the minimization of the error. Because obviously, if you choose if you just have the maximum possible number of clusters, then you have one data point in each cluster, and you have an error of zero, which it's not very helpful, right? So, I mean, in this case, can we see more or less what might be the best number of clusters in this example? I mean, our guess would be roughly either three or four. Yeah. Okay. Let me quickly check the time. We're still good on time. Okay. So far we've been talking about this hard clustering where the assignment of data points to clusters is a hard decision. It says you are a part of cluster A, but you're not a part of the other clusters. Well, it's possible that you can have clustering methods that essentially give you probabilities of whether or not this data point belongs to this or that cluster. All right. So the whole point of it allows for cluster overlap. So I'm going to, do I have this example here? Let me jump back. So for instance, in this example here, I mean, maybe it's not such an intelligent choice to say, okay, this point is definitely belonging to B or to the brown points, but not the blue points. When in reality, using a soft clustering result, you might say, okay, this point here, 50% belongs to the brown points, 50% belongs to the blue points. Yeah? That is the reason why we have an interest in these soft clustering methods. So some examples of different methods. For instance, there's C-means, which you can check out in the book. It's more heuristic, kind of rule of thumb based. It's also centroid based. And a sample's memberships of different centroids adds up to one. Essentially, these data points have different probabilities that they belong to different clusters. A more interesting soft clustering or fuzzy clustering method is the use of Gaussian mixture models. It's much more formal than C-means. Essentially, it's probability distribution based. More or less, it's saying, rather than using centroids, it says, okay, we have a Gaussian distribution where its mean is at this location with this standard deviation, and therefore we can calculate the likelihoods that data points belong to this or that Gaussian distribution, this or that cluster. And I'm using the term relative likelihood quite intentionally because, as you will recall, these Gaussian distributions, you can write them out as probability density functions, which you'll recall back to lecture one on the topic of evaluating relative likelihoods of data points from distributions, right? But again, this is just a visualization of fuzzy clustering. So for example, let's try to choose a somewhat interesting data point. This data point here, this is kind of more of, with regards to C-means. You might say it's 60% of the green class, 35% of the blue class, and roughly 5% of the purple class, right? Okay, but we get the overall idea of fuzzy or soft clustering, right? So this non-binary membership of data points to clusters. And so let's just talk a little bit about the Gaussian mixture model a bit more. So it's clustering that's based on representations of each cluster as a Gaussian distribution. So for instance, in this case, I think this is the end result of the clustering, and that we have these three Gaussian distributions on the data, which you can see are overlapping each other. You can see where their mean is, and you can see more or less their covariance matrix, the spread in the different directions regarding the different distributions, right? Um, The interesting thing about Gaussian mixture models, other than that it does fuzzy clustering, is how it is trained. It's trained using a method called expectation maximization. Because what it does is it adjusts the hyperparameters of the different probability density functions. So in the case of Gaussian distributions, these hyperparameters that we're talking about are the mean of the distribution and, say, the covariance matrix of the distribution, more or less the standard deviation, but in multiple dimensions. So here's the point. It fits the clusters, the Gaussians, to the data iteratively by determining the likelihood that the Gaussian distribution generated the data, and it attempts to maximize this likelihood. So essentially what you do is you randomly select, say, the mean or the covariance of these different Gaussians. You then calculate the likelihood that the data points belonged or were created by these Gaussians. And then using these relative likelihoods, you actually use them to weigh your data set to recalculate the mean and covariance of the different Gaussians. And then they essentially merge onto the data slowly. And I have a different example of this slowly in a couple of slides, I think. So big point is you make an assumption on the mean and covariance of the Gaussians, use the relative likelihood that the data points belong to the different Gaussians to weigh your data to then recalculate the mean and covariance. Another interesting thing about Gaussian mixture models is that you can use cross-validation to guess the number of clusters in your data set, which is a quite unique thing about Gaussian mixture models. And we'll see an example of that later. Okay, here is an example of the maximization process. So this is a one-dimensional example. I took this image from this YouTube video. He explains it quite well as well. But here, we made a guess of, okay, these Gaussian distributions have a mean located here and here, the standard deviation of this amount. Calculating the relative likelihood of the data points belong to each of the Gaussians, you then can use that to weigh the data to then calculate new means, a new covariance matrices, standard deviations in this case, of the Gaussian distributions, and you repeat this process iteratively until you converge. In this case, you are maximizing the so-called log likelihood function. Before we get into the practical tasks, I originally said that these slides would be kind of extra slides because getting into the math is a bit much. But I might want to cover a little bit. Let me just quickly look. Let me just highlight some things. I'm not going to go over it in detail. More or less, we have this log likelihood estimator or function that we're trying to optimize. This is the objective function. It returns results to you that are negative. So essentially, the closer you get to zero, the better your results are. Or I'd say the more optimal your results are. And I've explicitly said what is the expectation step, kind of say selecting these Gaussian hyperparameters and calculating the likelihood that that each distribution generates the data points, and the maximization step of recomputing the mean variance of the different Gaussians. But no, I'm not going to go over it too much. But here is a visual example, another GIF of this process showing the change of the Gaussian distributions, their mean, and their variance over time. Right? So at least we got the gist of what a Gaussian mixture model is. Yeah. Another soft clustering method that we can use cross-validation to make a guess as to what the appropriate number of clusters are. All right, let me check the time. Whoops. I quit out of it. It might I think it is time for a break before we get into these kind of practical problems. So now, why don't we take a 10-minute break, and we'll reconvene at 11:07, yeah? Okie dokie. All right. Let's grab this just in case I need to do an example. Okay. Actually, I think these parts are going to go relatively quickly, so we may not spend too much time on this. So in the tutorial document, we're just essentially asking you to perform clustering on these particular elements, right? Unlabeled, and they only have two attributes. Saying group it into two different clusters, and you can check your results with like a statistical package. See if you did it right. Okay, so like we said, what is the first thing that we want to do if we're doing k-means clustering? Find the number of clusters. So in this case, we will have two clusters. And where do we put those clusters to start out with?
As far away from each other as possible.
You do try to put them as far away each other as possible. And in this case, we're using two data points with the largest distance as our starting centroids. This is a bit of a manufactured example. So cluster one, I'm trying to see individual 1, 4. Individual in this case is referring to the particular element. Ignore that for now. But the centroid we're having at 1 and 1 and 5 and 7, right? These are our coordinates. So here. And right now our cluster centroids are on top of two different data points. Okay? We've done this. What's the next step that we want to do?
Start moving them.
What do we do before we can move them?
The distance. Yeah,
right. So we need to measure the distances between, say, centroid 1 and every single data point here. Likewise, with centroid 2 and every single data point. And what we do is we say, okay, whichever one is closer to that particular centroid, at the moment, it belongs to that particular cluster, right? So for element 1, which I don't know why I'm organizing like this, but just bear with me here. Element 1, it's no distance away from the centroid, but quite far away from centroid 2. Obviously goes to cluster 1, and likewise you can see with cluster 2. But in this case, we can see that this data point here is equidistant between the two centroids, which is a possibility that can happen. And in this case, ties can be broken by some arbitrary rule. But in our case, the rule is simply to assign the sample to the smaller cluster. So we can see that the majority of the samples are going to cluster 2, right? They're closer to the second centroid. So we're saying at the moment, okay, this point here belongs to cluster 1. Now we can move our centroids. And how do we move our centroids?
To the center of the cluster.
Yeah, so you move it to the center of the cluster, which is just the average of the features of that particular cluster. So we recalculate the coordinates of the centers, centroids, the centroids of each of the two clusters, and we get these new positions, right? Now we have a centroid here and a centroid there. All right, are we done yet? No, we're not done yet. So what do we do? Exactly. We find the distances between each of the data points and each of the centroids, and we're trying to define, okay, which of these data points is closest to their respective centroid, and then those data points will go into that, into that cluster. And we can see here all of the assignments remain the same except for this point 3 right here. So now we're saying, okay, now all these points belong to cluster 2, and only these points belong to cluster 1, and like you say, we need to move our centroids, right? So we recalculate the means of the clusters, the centers, when you have our new centroid positions here. So if we calculate the distances between all these data points in the centroids, are we going to see any switches between the data points? No, we're not. What does that mean?
We are done.
We're done. Exactly. It's over. So there's no changes in cluster assignments, which is, say, one of our stopping criteria. So we're finished. And likewise, we've reached some local minimum with respect to the within cluster sum of squared errors. Okay, so I think we have a handle on k-means. That's good. Now we're doing an example talking about hierarchical agglomerative, this bottom-up clustering, where you start off with single data points until you get up to, say, like, in this case, we just want to stop when we have two clusters in the final splitting. Of course, you can go higher than that. And we're asking here, it says, reduce amount of clusters based on Euclidean distance between the objects, object groups in each step. So the dissimilarity metric we're using is the Euclidean distance. And in this case, we're going to use single linkage to calculate the distance between the clusters. And at the end, we're also going to draw a tree representing the agglomerative clustering, right? How these clusters merge and, say, at what levels. So we start off with these data points, which I've drawn very beautifully here. And recall single linkage is the measure which is saying that the two closest data points in clusters is the points on the clusters that we're measuring the distance. So what data points here might be the ones that we first merge just by the data points?
A and B.
A and B. And you'd be right. So basically what we're doing is we're measuring the distances between each of the clusters using single linkage. And we can see here, distance between A and B is the smallest of all of these. Yeah. Voila, that's a cluster. Okay. And what might be the second merging that occurs here? It's funny because I cannot remember what it actually is. So it's either D and E, or what else might it be? Yeah, so the single linkage distance between this cluster here and this cluster is the distance between A and F. But let's verify. Here, in this case, the distance between AB and F is 2.23, and the distance between D and E is also 2.23, so we're both correct in this regard. So this merges at the same time. And then, what next might we merge? Yeah. So I would say that this distance here, using a single linkage, is likely the smallest. Let's double check. D and E and C. Yep. And this is the clustering result we end up with, more or less a cluster of C, D, and E, and B, A, and F. And this is the representation of it as a dendrogram. And we can see that the merging of A, B, F, and D, and E occurs at the same level. But basically, we limit our clustering just up to two clusters. So that's why we draw that line there. Yeah? So do we have a pretty good feeling on at least agglomerative hierarchical clustering and the representation of it as a tree? This just shows the first merge was A, B. the second was tied for ABF and DNE. Then we did DNE, DEC. And then at the end, you could tie it together at the top. Okay. So actually, I think this is the last problem that we have. And here we're going to use Weka. And we're also using a sponge data set. And this data set is highly nominative. There's many non-numerical values in it. So there's some conversion of the data into some sort of a numerical form. It's also, I believe it's in Spanish as well. And we have only 77 different samples. But we have how many features? 45 features. A lot of different features. So the task here is more or less try using k-means and expectation maximization clustering on this data set. And just change the number of predefined clusters in some range between 1 and 50. And we want to think about which number of clusters gives the best result. So I secretly know what the correct number of classes for the sponge data set is, the real number, say, of groupings is. What methods might we use to estimate the appropriate number of clusters, say, for k-means? The elbow method, yeah. And for expectation maximization, we can actually use a method of cross-validation, which I'll show more explicitly. Okay, so let's just take a look at the data, look at Weka first. I've already uploaded the data here. So we go to the cluster tab. We are going to choose simple k-means first. And we can change some variables here. Let's say number of clusters. Why not? Let's just say start at 2. Let's see what we get. All right. So we have an equal split between the two different samples. And the, where is it? Here. Here is the within cluster sum of squares error written down here. And we can repeat this process more or less over and over again for varying numbers of clusters. Here you can still see that there's a decent distribution of the samples across the different clusters, even though we have 10 clusters. Within cluster sum of squared errors, you can see it's reducing. That's to be expected. But let's just run all the way to the end and see what happens, say, if we choose, I don't know, let's say 55 clusters. Let's see if anything funny happens. All right at the moment, I'm looking for potentially empty clusters, which can happen if you choose too many clusters. But in this case, it looks like each cluster potentially has at least one data point. And we can see the error is now down to 100. Okay, so that's all fine and dandy. And I've also written down some results I've gotten before. Right? So K and the error we calculated, et cetera, et cetera. And we get a graph like this, at least for the data points that I tested. Of course, I didn't test all possible k's, but where might we guess the actual number of, what is the true number of clusters, according to our graph, you think, using the elbow method? Yeah. So, in general, of course, I could have done more sampling, but I would say somewhere between 10 and 30 at the moment. You can make some more educated guesses. But that's the thing about the elbow method. You essentially are guessing based upon your data. Yeah? So everybody have your guesses for the number of clusters. You think it's 30, you think it's 20, you think it's whatever you think it is. I think it's 20. Okay, so let's repeat the same process, but now with expectation maximization. And like I said before, this objective function, this error that you're calculating, is this log likelihood value, which is always negative. So when we were optimizing it, essentially, you want to go up towards zero, right? So this is from the case of 2 and 10, but let's just, for fun, see how it works in Mica. Whoops, that's not what I wanted. Expectation maximization. And if you choose the number of clusters as negative 1, it tries to select the number of clusters for you using its cross-validation method. So let's, for example, say 2. And you can see here you can make certain limitations on your Gaussian distributions. Oh, this is maximum number of clusters. Excuse me. What I want to change is this number of clusters. And you can change the seed as well. More or less changes the starting positions. Okay. And here, it's actually quite nice because it shows you, well, actually, not exactly sure what it's showing me up there. But the main point, here's the distribution of the clusters, log likelihood. And we can repeat this process over the same number of clusters that we did before, for example. And in this case, we even had an empty cluster when we had k equals 50. This is possible. You can end up with empty clusters. Okay, so according to the actual data set, there's 12 classes. When you're doing expectation maximization, using its heuristic of cross-validation, it will estimate that the number of clustered instances is 4. It's making a guess of 4. And we can look and see how this works here. Let me move this. The cross-validation performed to determine the number of clusters is done in the following steps. The number of clusters is set to 1. The training set is split randomly into 10 folds. Expectation maximization is performed 10 times using the 10 folds, using its usual way. The log likelihood is averaged all over 10 results, and if the log likelihood has increased, the number of clusters is increased by 1, and the program continues. So what's kind of interesting here is that I think let's do number of clusters here being 4, using the seed of 100. And we have negative 24 as the log likelihood, but what if we do number of clusters being 5? Here it actually increased, but this is only for this particular seed, this particular sample. So if you change the seed, you may get a worse or lower log likelihood. So that's why it's doing this tenfold cross-validation. So in this case, funnily enough, this K means elbow method. I can't say with certainty with confidence which method was performing better, but you can see there's different methods of doing estimation of clusters. Or you can use your own expertise, which is very common. But yes, that's all I have for today. Thank you for attending the lectures. Best of luck with the homework. If you have any questions, send me an email, et cetera, et cetera. And yes, I think next week we also have a guest speaker. I can't remember who it is, but be sure to check that out. So, thank you and good luck.